Hello and welcome to the Doorsteps podcast. I'm Dr. Cody Price. And before I introduce you all to my guest today, I would like to welcome Kellen Craig as my co-host for this episode. Kellen is the director of the Office of Multifamily Housing at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency, leading administration of the state's low-income housing tax credit program, multifamily bond program, and several gap financing programs. He has also been with OFA for 7 years, having joined the agency in February of 2014. Welcome to the podcast, Kellen.
Glad to be here.
And for my guests, I would like to welcome Mayor Ben Kessler and Council President Lori Ann Feibel. Ben Kessler is the mayor of the city of Bexley, and in that capacity also serves as the city's development director. With a professional background in commercial real estate appraisal, Mayor Kessler brings a strong understanding of real estate finance and market valuation to his role, helping to inform community development strategies for the city. Ben and his family are longtime Bexley residents, and in their free time, they enjoy all-season hiking, family Minecraft builds, and a diverse array of outdoor activities. And then elected to office in 2013 to Bexley City Council and re-elected in 2017, Lori Ann currently is serving her second term as council president. She earned both her undergraduate and master's degree in social studies education from The Ohio State University. Lori Ann and Jonathan, her husband of 25 years, are passionate volunteers for multiple organizations throughout the metropolitan area. And so thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having us, Cody.
Starting off, for those that may not be familiar with Bexley, can you kind of provide a brief description and maybe even a history of the city of Bexley to our listeners?
Yeah, I guess I'll start and maybe Lauren, you can chip in. But the city of Bexley was founded in 1908 as a village. Kind of interesting history. It came together as two separate little neighborhoods, the neighborhood of Pleasant Ridge, which was where Capital University had centered or found its home in central Ohio after moving from what is now the Short North. And then the area of called Bullitt Park, which was where the Jeffrey Mansion was and other sort of country estates at the time. And so kind of this learned, small education community from the university and then sort of the titans of Columbus came together and formed a pretty economically diverse community. And Bexley's origin story, I think, has continued to inform the way that the community works and interacts. You know, I think that there are a lot of perceptions about Bexley that may or may not be correct, that it's all wealthy individuals. That's not the case. Bexley has a pretty wide variety of socioeconomic backgrounds. It is, you know, one of the first ring suburbs in Columbus. So it's very close to downtown. It's really close to the airport, but it's, you know, it's a 3 or 4 mile bike ride downtown from Bexley. So we enjoy having sort of an urban environment to our suburban neighborhood. You know, we have, like I kind of already mentioned, a diversity of incomes. We have a diversity of housing options today. But if I would characterize our lower income housing today, it would be apartment complexes that have sort of declined over the years and just due to attrition have become essentially de facto low income housing options for residents. And I know we're about to get into this, but that'll kind of inform our conversation as we move forward about what we're trying to achieve in Bexley with our housing goals. Lorianne, what else?
Not only do we have a diversity of incomes, we have one of the things I love most about Bexley is the fact that we have such a diverse group of individuals with all kinds of talents that they are so willing to share. And many of them are so very passionate about giving and helping. And I think that is what has put us in the position to be sharing this exciting piece of legislation with you today.
One more thing I'd say to add to all that, I think I kind of started in on like our history and then fast forwarded to today and didn't really fill in the gaps. It's geographically a small community. We're a 2.5 square mile city of 14,000 residents. So we're among other cities in central Ohio, we're kind of on the smaller side. We are compact in footprint, which is really has so many positives to it, which means we're a very walkable neighborhood. You know, we pride ourselves that you could pretty much hit every address by sidewalk in Bexley. We have a very walkable retail corridor down on Main Street with, you know, a grocery store, historic theater, like just a whole variety of restaurants and options for residents. But I think the underpinning to all of that, you know, the households, the sidewalks, the community, the families, is also this educational fabric that we have in our city. So we started with Capital University. We have Columbus School for Girls. We have St. Charles, and we have a fantastic public school system in the Bexley School District. And so one commonality, I think, among many of our residents is this desire for lifelong learning that's authentic and literally built into the fabric of the community in terms of our institutional footprint in Bexley. I think it's an important thing to know about our city.
Great. Well, why don't we dive right in for the reason that we're here. In September 2020, Bexley became the sixth community in Ohio and the first in Central Ohio to enact a source of income discrimination ordinance. So at its core, can you explain the Bexley ordinance and who it protects?
So this piece of legislation will protect individuals who have some form of federal voucher that allows them to obtain housing.
If I can maybe expound upon what Lorianne's saying, the ordinance itself was actually, it's three words. It adds source of income to our fair housing law. So it literally adds to racial, sexual, national discrimination, disability discrimination, just simply source of income. And so the interpretation of that is pretty broad, and it will, I think, have pretty broad and sweeping implications. And I think one thing that has been so clear, especially recently, we've actually had more experience since we passed this ordinance, just in going through the zoning process for a mixed income housing development here in Bexley, and learning more about the importance of this ordinance that I think we even maybe appreciated when we passed it, which is that income discrimination is a very real thing. And I can tell you from administering our city code, how well somebody maintains their property or what sort of criminal conduct they engage in has nothing to do with their income. I mean, that is something that, you know, we see code enforcement violations across every single income strata. We see criminal activity across every income strata. There's just such a built-in prejudice based upon income and ability to pay that is pretty prevalent today, and I'm sure probably has been prevalent for a long time. But I think it's an important value statement for our community to say that as we have postured and positioned ourselves as a welcoming community of all, community that accommodates a variety of perspectives, a variety of backgrounds, a variety of races and ages and abilities, that also accommodating a variety of incomes is important. And that sense of compassion and welcoming is the foundation beneath this ordinance, why it was created and why we believe it's so important.
So kind of going off that, you're the sixth community in Ohio to actually do this. I mean, there's more communities that are considering it. Obviously, there is issues that's happening. People are being discriminated against. Is this something that Bexley kind of saw? And then you guys were like, we are going to be this community that is welcoming. We're no longer going to give those people the power to discriminate against them based on their income. So we're going to fix it. Is that?
Two stories to it. Lorianne has one story and I have another. So I think we should tag team it on this one.
Okay. Cody, we always say that my favorite motto that Ben says of our city is we are founded in 1908 and we're updated daily. And updating our fair housing laws was just another progressive way of keeping up with the times and making sure that our value of equity is documented. We also believe that while we may not have documented cases of that happening in our city, we don't know that it's not happening in our city. We also know that our rental properties have a very slow turnover rate, so that we know that oftentimes the vouchers may not even be used because of that, because the people get into their apartments, they love Bexley, and they stay here. But that doesn't mean that by Bexley making that statement and putting that into our laws, that it doesn't have a far-reaching effect. I did hear that you say Reynoldsburg. I heard you say Westerville. I know Westerville has followed us. I know they looked at our piece of legislation and they followed our piece of legislation. I know that Columbus is thinking about it. I'm also president of the Whitehall-Bexley Rotary, and we have Lori Elmore as a council person for the city of Whitehall, and she and I have collectively been talking about her doing the exact same thing in Whitehall. I'm hoping, I often say that when I legislate, I always wear my mom hat, I am the most proud of the fact that I have raised three children, but I also wear my mom hat for all the kids in our community and all the potential children in our community. And I'm well aware of the data that suggests that when you move children out of positions of poverty and into communities like Bexley, our surrounding communities, and they have a much greater success of thriving in the future.
I think the other thing we should point out is that we have many rock star residents, but Amy Claiben, who's been very active in this space and advocating, Rachel Cleet, who is at the Ohio State University, have both been strong advocates helping us think through this and work on it. I became pretty passionate about it when we had some really firsthand experience with the issue. And that was the Bexley CIC, or Community Improvement Corporation, is working on improving the condition of housing in a certain area of our city. And in doing so, has become active in purchasing some property that sits on top of a former landfill and is not safe for human habitation. So we're working on ultimately cleaning up that former landfill, and we're working on providing additional mixed income housing units for the community. In doing so, we have created our own custom voucher program whenever we've been in a position where residents have been displaced from housing that's unsafe, and that we're working on redeveloping into safer options. So we've created a custom voucher program. We have had tenants who have qualified for that, and we've assisted them with relocating into other housing units in the city. And in doing so, learned very quickly, very firsthand, that the word voucher was received with more than skepticism, was outright rejected. Even though what we were talking about wasn't even some of the traditional vouchers that we hear about, where there's a little bit more of a program involved. Ours was a very simple allowance. It was backed by the good faith of the Community Improvement Corporation to the city of Bexley, and could not have been simpler. It was simply a check that was going to be delivered to the landlord every month. Nonetheless, there was immediate skepticism and immediate rejection of tenants before even doing a background check or understanding other fundamental factors that are important, obviously, when landlords are selecting or allowing tenants in the property. So it just became really obvious that, like, this is a problem. Like, it's one thing to say that, somebody's had a history of evictions or had a history of certain types of criminal activity. It's another thing altogether to just outright reject somebody because you don't like the way that they're paying their rent. That's when I became very passionate about it, and something that had been a little more academic became real and became something that I think we started to take very seriously.
So you alluded to some of the skepticism from landlords. Can you talk a little bit about the process that the city and stakeholders went to, and what were some of the challenges? Were you met with perhaps some similar skepticism among fellow community leaders and, members of the community, who were similarly skeptical?
We met with some apartment associations and certain landlords who reached out to us to talk about the ordinance and how they wanted to understand it a little bit better, and they had some concerns about it. And we listened, and Lori, maybe you just talk about ultimately what we did with that feedback and how we decided to move forward in light of it.
As Ben highlighted, Amy Claiben and Rachel Cleet are two rock star advocates for this piece of legislation, and they are taking it from city to city, trying to gain support. And so they really were amazing in guiding us through this process. I did, however, do my own research with some data. I found some really important things out about what can happen for individuals who are blessed with actually being able to use these vouchers. I think the numbers are like only 1 in 4 individuals who actually qualify to get a voucher can get a voucher. And then when landlords make it impossible to actually get a house once you get that voucher, it's really, it's saddening. So they were rock stars in helping us. And then I reached out to the mayor of University Heights, Mayor Brennan, and I also talked to Mayor Wello from South Euclid. And I asked them, because the biggest question that realtors were making a big deal about the idea of rental properties just going up, that renters would make their leases so high that then these individuals wouldn't qualify anyway, and then it would make it uncomfortable for everyone to be able to afford to live in our community. And I asked these two mayors if they had seen that in their communities, because the data that I read, the research that was provided that I tried to find, suggested absolutely the opposite. And Ben kept encouraging me on and on. He goes, "This is economics. You know, that is not what drives rent payments." And I also talked to Charles Hillman from Columbus Metropolitan Housing Authority, and he was very enthusiastic and very helpful when it came to getting this moving. And we have such a large group of individuals who are very passionate about affordable housing in our community that it was not challenging to get this piece of legislation passed.
Can we get a timeline for this? So when, it passed in September 2020, but when was the idea initially floated to you or proposed to you from Amy or Rachel? I don't know if they are the ones that proposed. And then just kind of knowledge for other communities. And it's just I assume that it's a timely process, but it may not have been for your case. So can you kind of attach dates to when things kind of happened?
Absolutely. Sorry. I think it was probably about October of 2019 that I sat down with Amy Klavan without a mask on in our local coffee shop. And we had a really nice conversation about it. And it soon after, the holidays came and we met, I believe, in January with maybe one or two of our other council members, they met with them, with our council members, just to kind of see what kind of support other council members might have for something like this. And then COVID hit. I think we talked about it again, maybe in July. And then the ball started rolling a little bit more seriously, if that's the question that you're asking.
Yeah.
Yeah, it can move really quickly. And as Ben said, you just add, if you have fair housing legislation, it's very simple. An addition to it is, it can be as simple as two words.
Yeah. So, and I think just to flesh out a little bit more, Lori and I sat down in July of 2020 and put pen to paper with all these things we've been talking about. And it was a very quick process from there. And you define source of income, and then you add that to your fair housing. And we, throughout the month of August and September, we met with some of those property owners and advocates. And I think ultimately, our feeling from talking to them was that there needed to be a little bit more education about what it actually meant. And we worked on that and understood that there were going to be certain objections that we just couldn't accommodate. Ultimately, the idea of putting our stake in the ground and saying that source of income discrimination is not appropriate is not going to jive with everybody. And there are going to be some people that felt, that they would never approve of that idea. And we knew that. And I think we just respectively disagreed with some of those perspectives, and we carried on. Now, we have a benefit because we're a small community. And so we have a small number of stakeholders relatively that we can interact with very personably on a one-on-one basis. And so that allows us to pass this sort of legislation in a way that's not even fast. It's just, a little bit more, consensus building does not necessarily take as long. And we've seen that in other other ordinances like a plastic bag ban or, certain types of distracted driving ordinances that we've done things a little bit differently. And we've been able to do it because we have a human scale to our interaction where we can reach out to people and build consensus a little bit more efficiently. And the relationships are just very one-to-one relationship. So it's when you sit down and you talk to somebody about something, that's a different interface than when you have a public meeting with, 50 constituents that are upset about something. So I think that's one of the advantages that we had in passing the ordinance the way that we did.
So to add to that, you know, your ordinance passed nearly unanimously, and you had a, you know, sounds like a pretty smooth public engagement process. Did you run into any neighborhood resistance or, you know, other constituents who were opposed to the legislation?
Well, the objections that we heard were from landlords, not, I can't recall neighborhood opposition or individual resident opposition. I don't think that that was a component here. We've encountered that subsequently in other housing topics, but not on this concept.
No, that's good. And we experienced that. I mean, at OFA, you know, financing affordable housing, we're often on the receiving end of correspondence from neighbors and community leaders, depending on their opinion of particular developments that have been proposed. So not unusual, but great that Bexley, you know, got through the process quickly and was able to build consensus around the ordinance.
Now that the ordinance has passed, what have been the immediate steps for communication or implementation of the new law once it was passed?
A lot of our engagement happened and our education with landlords happened prior to the effective date. And it was, you know, literally conversations with landlords throughout the city. Our next step is to send some more casual sort of background information, resources for education on for landlords on different programs that exist. And we have letters a letter that we've been drafting to try to send to all of the landlords that are registered in the city. So it's been sort of an organic communication process.
So has education then mostly been towards the landlord side of it, or has there been, are there resources available made to potential residents that is just like may not be aware of this protection and trying to find housing and maybe they experience an issue? What is some of the guidance that you then suggested them that may be experiencing this?
We know that CMHA is aware of our ordinance as the administrator of, you know, most of the vouchers that we're talking about. So I guess we've relied on agencies that are administering the vouchers to help make potential tenants aware, because frankly, we just don't have access to that universe of potential tenants. We haven't come across yet an example of somebody who has had a voucher or a source of income that's not a traditional source of income that's attempted to rent and has had issues with that. So we haven't gotten into any, you know, enforcement type issues yet. Certainly open to thinking of new and better ways of communicating out to potential tenant populations. Frankly, when you ask the question, I'm sitting here thinking, how would we even reach out to, you know, the unknown population of tenants that might want to take advantage of this, other than through the agencies directly, which is where we've mostly focused our communication.
On a tangentially related topic, do you find that there is available rental housing at the price point that someone with a voucher actually has access to available affordable housing that can be covered by the voucher?
Yes, that's a great question. And I think the answer to that question is not a whole lot of it. I think, especially because the majority of the housing stock that would potentially fall within those income bands is not up to standard from a maintenance perspective, from my understanding. So maintenance isn't even the right word. We were alluding to a former landfill. We have several apartment complexes developed on that, and that's the area that we're trying to environmentally remediate. And, you know, I think that those properties in general probably do not comply with or would not be eligible for voucher program. So the answer is there are some complexes that probably fit within that range, but we don't have a huge number of units that would fall within it.
So how do you see this ordinance fitting into your broader housing plan, since access may be an issue that you're grappling with?
I think it's a yes and. I mean, I think it's true that we knew that from the beginning, while we believed strongly in this ordinance, it wasn't going to be this like game changer for housing in Bexley. It was more of a step along the way. And there's a whole lot more steps that are involved. And you know, I alluded to the some mixed income housing development that we've been encouraging in the city. That's currently under plan and hopefully something that moves forward. So this is one of many steps. Lori, what would you say to that?
Yeah, we use that phrase yes and often. We are landlocked. We don't have a lot of room to create more housing. We have to do our very best to be as welcoming in any way we possibly can. So we have to think into the future. having equity always in every way we possibly can in our community is very important to us. And so if we are blessed in the future with a larger stock of rental properties for individuals, we want to make sure that this piece of legislation is in place.
I mean, speaking of that, would an inclusionary zoning policy be something that Bexley would consider so that any new development, that a piece of it, say 10%, needs to be made affordable? Is that a logical next step to providing equity and adding this legislation to the ordinance that you guys just passed?
I don't think we've ever put a percentage on it, but when we talk about redeveloping or reinventing a specific area of our community, affordable housing is always a component of that plan.
Yeah, just a little more detail. So, you know, one of the challenges we've had in finding siting for the proposed mixed income housing developments that we've looked at is, you know, we are fully developed, 100% built out community. And so anything that we are talking about is redevelopment. And not just redevelopment, but redevelopment often of, you know, 0.3 acre sites, right? So we're not talking about like developers coming in and building 100 apartment units, and then, you know, you can slice off a certain amount for affordability. I don't know that that type of formula works particularly well, given the development footprint of Bexley and the super specialized nature of most of the development that occurs. Another way we have approached it, and not to say, by the way, not to say, Cody, that that's not something we should look into and think about some more and understand more. And I'd like to know, for example, how does that work with, you know, OFA that wants to fund, maybe I'm putting words in OFA's mouth, but, you know, their sweet spot is 50 units or whatever. I'm not sure, or so I've been told. That might be a total myth. But like, how does that work when you have such a small development, and maybe that's something where you're not even using that type of finance? So That's information I think would be really good to delve into. Also, Bexley has a 100% tax abatement program for affordable housing, or for units that are below a certain cost threshold. So there's an enhanced incentive within our Main Street district for affordability. That's one way we've approached it, and is certainly a way that I think we want to continue to approach it. We try to figure out what incentives can we put into place, what requirements can we put into place that are most compatible with the sorts of development that might occur in Bexley.
Why don't we go back to one of the basic things, and just how do potential residents or residents who are searching for housing with a voucher or another source of income who may experience housing discrimination, how do they report that? What is the enforcement mechanism that the city is going to use to ensure that folks are able to access housing?
So yeah, if there's been a violation of our fair housing law, and that would, this would be included underneath that, then because this is not something that's protected through state statute, it wouldn't go to the House Civil Rights Commission. It would go straight to our mayor's court. So somebody would file a complaint in writing. Our prosecuting attorney at mayor's court would prosecute the case, and the fine for the offender is up to $1,000 for a first offense. And it scales up to second and third offenses, $2,500 for second, $5,000 for a third. So it's basically, you know, exponentially penalizing somebody who is in violation of the fair housing law. So it's through the mayor's court system.
What advice might you have for other communities who are looking to enact this type of ordinance, or community leaders who may be hesitant to kind of dip their toe in this area?
My advice would be, I would love to give them a call and have a chat with them. I would love to share my experience with them. I would love to put them into contact with Amy Claven, because she would be willing to help, and she is very capable of providing talking points and really great literature that helps you realize just how important this can possibly be for individuals. I mean, the data is overwhelmingly convincing when you look at the success that can exist in taking families out of poverty and giving them an opportunity to live in a better house, a better community.
I have OFA specific question or comment. OFA's 9% housing credit application deadline was February 11th, and there actually is a proposal in from Bexley, which I think is exciting, because, you know, we want to see you know, our suburban communities build housing that's affordable to individuals at 80% AMI and below. It's also a way for communities who may not be able to take the step that Bexley did. You know, if they build housing developed with this tax credit program, they're required by federal law to permit housing vouchers. And so is one way to, you know, ensure that individuals, you know, with those sources of income have access to housing. But anything that you would like to share about your housing plan and how tax credit developments fit into that picture?
Yeah, so we actually set out very purposely through our CIC to engage a mixed income housing developer to help identify potential sites and potential projects for the city. And so what you're referring to, Callan, is the first fruits of that. It's a development, so actually a multi-site development. It's our first foray into this type of housing. And it's actually been really helpful to have the source of income ordinance on the books, because even though it doesn't speak specifically to the proposal here, we've already put our value statement out to say that, you know, source of income is not a reason for discrimination. And so that, even though already, like, that's not legally supposed to be the part of a zoning hearing, nonetheless, you know, source of income comes up in testimony at zoning hearings, and the community through its elected officials have already spoken and said that's not something that we're going to allow discrimination on the basis of. And specifically, therefore, you know, if somebody is concerned that we have a housing development coming in that might allow or accept vouchers, guess what? So does every other apartment complex. I mean, that's not that now this is no longer a different sort of thing than what exists already today. So I think that they're complementary. You know, I think that this helps lay the stage for a jurisdiction like ours to embrace and welcome a mixed income housing development that serves a broader swath of our community than we might be serving today. I think it's important. I think that access to housing that's affordable should be in every single neighborhood and every single city in America. And it shouldn't be confined to a certain area of our city. It shouldn't be confined to a certain socioeconomic surrounding. And I think it's really important for communities such as ours to put our money where our mouth is and put our best foot forward and lead by example. And so, you know, we're really hopeful about the application that you have in front of you today. And we're looking forward to seeing that become a very productive and positive new component of our community.
So kind of after everything that we've really discussed today, what are some of the major takeaways that you wish everybody should know about either the enaction process or having communities get source of income discrimination ordinances passed in their community?
I think, you know, find out who your major allies are and working on it and start having conversations with your community. And that's whether you're a policymaker or you're a constituent. I think with us, this is an instance where we had an idea brought to us by a constituent, and we listen to all the ideas that constituents bring us, and they get the conversation started and builds from there. So I think start the conversation. That's like the first step, right? And then see what happens. Take it from there.
My major takeaway for this is that it's all about equity and making sure that individuals are welcome into our community. And we have no intention of telling people how to run their business, but we have every intention of making sure that people are treated fairly in our community.
Another takeaway that I have, Cody, is just, you know, it's always helpful when you're the first at doing something in the area. You don't really have other people to turn to be like, hey, how are you administering this? Like, how are you getting the word out? What are you doing? And obviously, just like any of us, we have a million things going on at once. So it's helpful just to kind of focus back and think, you know, we passed a law. Now what do we do? You know, and I think that's a big piece that we're going to need to continue to tackle is how do we make this law mean as much as it can mean?
And so finally, if both of you could have everybody read one book, what would it be and why?
Without a doubt, I would have everyone read Jeanette Wall's memoirs of her life that she called Glass Castles. I am a huge fan of historic fiction. And let me tell you, she is amazing sharing her story. It is a story of resilience. And I love it. It's amazing.
So my selection has nothing to do with the topic at hand here. I apologize, but I've got to recommend it because I read it recently and it's kind of still blowing my mind. And I'm actually leading a book club for Arbor Day on it, which is The Overstory by Richard Powers. And it's a novel, won the Pulitzer Prize, but it's unique in that the major characters of the novel are trees. And so a tree shows up in these vignettes. You know, each vignette kind of has a different tree and the tree is a central character in the story. And then it all kind of, it's like a Dickensian way of all kind of comes together and the narrative coalesces. But it's really a stunning novel, and not just on its own literary merit, but in that you certainly learn a lot about our leafed friends.
Well, thank you all so much for taking the time today to speak to us about source of income discrimination ordinances.
Thanks, Cody, for having us. We're so excited to be able to share our hard work, and we're thrilled for you to share it with everyone else.
Thanks for having us. Really enjoyed the time with you guys today.
Thanks for joining.
To my listeners, please be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to the Doorsteps podcast so that you don't miss any updates about housing issues in Ohio. You can also follow the podcast and other research that the Office of Housing Policy at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency does by following our Twitter account @OhioDoorsteps. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Cody Price, and this is Doorsteps.